In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, following the truth wherever it leads, exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites, revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality, coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to Strange Planet. Great to have you aboard. Oh, about 70-some years ago, nuclear physicist Enrique Fermi reportedly was asked a question about UFOs. And he replied, this may be apocryphal, we're not really sure, we'll find out, but he supposedly said, well, if they exist, where are they? Where are they? And somehow this phrase or this question became known as the Fermi paradox. Ken Goodsword is here, and he just wrote a book called Fermi's Paradox is BS. That's the Family Show version. And Ken is a system analyst with expertise in industrial robotics, software engineering, and data design, and he enjoys applying these skills to ancient Hebrew and Sumerian documents, and of course, the UFO phenomena. And Ken's home on the web is dimensionfold.com, dimensionfold.com. Hey, Ken, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Hey, thanks for having me on the show today, Richard. It's really a privilege to be here.
Thank you. So, first of all, I was mistaken. I used to think that Fermi's paradox was in response to the Drake equation, this probabilistic argument that, you know, trying to estimate the number of active communicative ET civilizations within the Milky Way galaxy. Except the problem with that is the Drake equation, named after Dr. Frank Drake, that came out about a decade after Fermi reportedly asked the question, where are they? So it wasn't in response to the Drake equation, although one might argue it could have been, in the sense that the Drake equation is saying, well, there are all these, you know, the possibility for all of these ET civilizations, and then Fermi might have then posited, okay, where are they? But so let me back up, though. Let me ask you, first of all, to explain or kind of set the scene for us. 1950, yeah. Enrique Fermi.
Right. So just a couple of years earlier, there had been the Roswell incident, of course, which I probably don't need to say much about. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it. but essentially, what that did more than anything else was it made the flying saucer phenomenon, as it was kind of being called then, the Roswell incident turned that into kind of household name, I guess, if you will. And before that, there were certainly other UFO incidences, but they really, Roswell was what really broke it into the press, and it became a very popular story, and soon everyone was talking about it. And so a lot of speculation and a lot of discussion ensued after that. I'm actually writing another book that's going to be out in about a month, probably, called Before Roswell. And so in that book, I myself and my co-writer, Barbara DeLong, will discuss the fact that Roswell was not a new thing at all. There had been reports very similar to Roswell afterwards and before, and really for as long as humans have been talking, they've been talking about UFOs. And so that's kind of what that book is about. But in terms of in 1950, it was sort of a fresh idea in terms of just being something that people are discussing. So it's not surprising that Fermi and his colleagues would have discussed it during their lunch break, which apparently is what was happening. What is not necessarily known is whether they whether Fermi said anything about it, really, or because the fact that we have, like, you know, we quote him as saying, you know, where is everybody? But it's not a direct quote, and he never verified it. So it's sort of this backwards, like a retcon kind of a thing. And that's the whole thing of the Fermi paradox, particularly. So Fermi may or may not have even said anything about it.
He's pretty well known at the time, right? He was a nuclear physicist. He had never weighed in on the subject before. He never wrote any books or papers about it, right?
Right. It wasn't something that he was interested in, really, or certainly academically. He avoided the topic, or at least, you know, it wasn't part of his research. He was a nuclear physicist. He worked in, I believe he worked in the was it the Philadelphia experiment, or, you know, some of those early things where they were working on developing the nuclear bomb. So that was kind of his field. And I mean, it's a kind of an all consuming field. He probably didn't have time to write books about UFOs, even if he wanted to. But so it is interesting that you brought up the Drake equation, and it kind of is this paradox, supposedly, kind of is in response to the Drake equation. And the reason that we can say that is because it kind of has nothing to do with Fermi. And it didn't start when he said that. Like, there was no Fermi paradox until decades later. So at some point after Fermi's death, somebody had this idea, and they wanted to get more credibility out of it. And they thought that it would be good to attach someone famous's name to it. So they kind of retroactively credited it to Fermi, even though he had nothing to do with it. So it's kind of like reverse, what do you call it when you steal somebody's work?
Plagiarism.
Plagiarism, yeah. It's like reverse plagiarism in a way, where they're attempting to stick a famous person's name onto their idea.
Right, because
I don't know who.
Sorry, I'm just going to
go ahead.
We should give a definition of what is meant by a paradox. Is it?
Well, a paradox is kind of this is also an interesting point, because even the word paradox is not clearly defined, although it used to be, because it used to be well understood by logicians and philosophers that a paradox is something which apparently is true, but seems as if it shouldn't be.
Or the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. So now it's also the other way around. So it's like, it's something that's true that shouldn't be, or now, because of common usage, it's also come to mean something that isn't true that is, or that it seems like it should be, or
right.
But that's not really what it ever meant. So even the word paradox has become a bit of a paradox itself. So it's very, very strange. So in the book, I spend a good chapter kind of discussing the idea of paradoxes from a logician kind of a point of view. And I examine a lot of these, what would you call it, fallacies, like logical fallacies.
Right.
And so basically the idea behind the Fermi paradox is just chock full with a bunch of logical fallacies. However, I like to be fair, so I'm not going to just accuse whoever these guys were who invented this thing. Nobody knows. But I'm not just going to accuse them of using logical fallacies. I'm also pointing out that both sides of the argument, if you want to call it an argument, in terms of, you know, is there life in space or not, both believers and debunkers and skeptics, both sides are using different fallacies and sometimes the same fallacies. So, right. So I go through that a little bit in the book.
Let me just ask you, I could, Ken, first of all, mm-hmm. what is paradoxical about Fermi's statement or question, I should say? It's a question.
Yeah.
Where are they? What is paradoxical about that?
Well, really nothing, but ostensibly. So the reason why people think it's a paradox, even though it doesn't really hold water, but the rationale is that you're right. It comes back to the Drake equation. So so essentially the Drake equation says, you know, the universe is so big, and I'm just going to give you the oversimplified version.
Right.
The universe is so big. There's so many stars with so many planets around them. And so that there has to be another version of something like us, or something at least as intelligent or whatever. There's just got to be something out there, just statistically speaking.
Right.
Now, I mean, I statistics is possibly one of the evilest things that man has created. So I'm not even sure how much credence to put in statistics at all. But let's say, okay, maybe there's a valid point to the Drake equation. The Drake equation also has a whole bunch of flaws in terms of, mainly because all the variables that it uses, and there's probably 10 or 12 of them, all of them are essentially just pulled out of thin air, and they're not evidence-based. I mean, some of them have a little bit of evidence, but there's
like
a lot of...
Like predicting the climate using models.
Well, yes. It would be like predicting the climate using models if you were doing it in 1920 and the only models you had were, oh, look, put a balloon up in the atmosphere.
Okay.
Because that's kind of the level of reliability that we're looking at in that data. Now, having said that, astroscience and like the exploration of space has improved leaps and bounds in the last 10 years, and like even in the last 2 or 3 years, we are discovering things at an exponential rate that are very tightly integrated and related to the Drake equation and to the question of whether there may or may not be life in space. And that's kind of the main point of this book, is that we look at a lot of these new discoveries in science. For example, we now know of at least 5,000 exoplanets, and hundreds of those are within this so-called Goldilocks zone around their sun, which means that, you know, it's in a pretty good area in terms of not too hot, not too cold. And on top of that, we are finding traces of water and also oxygen and even biocarbon, like organic molecules, everywhere we look in space. So those are kind of three or four other chapters in the book where we look at, well, you know, maybe 10, even 10 years ago, it used to be you could ask and have a philosophical debate, is there water in space? Because nobody knew. And so you could guess, or, you know, and a lot of times this is what the Drake equation variables are, is just these like guesses from 10 years ago or whenever the Drake equation was founded. We've come a long way since then. So I think it's probably time for somebody to come up with a Drake 2.0. And I think that we would be working with a lot better variables and data now. But really, like, yeah, like I was saying, 10 years ago, you could say, you know, is there water in space? Well, who knows? And here's why I think this and why I think that. But now we know definitively that there is water pretty much everywhere we look. There's water on Mars. There's water on the moon. There's water in most of the planets within our solar system. Well, probably all of them, but we haven't confirmed a few of them. We have confirmed the presence of air on, or of like some kind of atmosphere on every single planet and other 9 other moons within our solar system. So the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, a lot of those, and our own moon even has an atmosphere, which is not something that we really were talking about 10 years ago. Now, it's not much of an atmosphere, but it's enough to make you have to look at where is it coming from, because the weird thing about the atmosphere on the moon is it can't stick around. Like, there's not enough gravity to keep it there, and so it goes drifting off into space, and yet it remains. Like, there's something there. So how is that possible? Well, it turns out that air is seeping out from the rock of the moon or inside the moon somewhere. And I'm not saying the moon is hollow, don't get me wrong. But somehow in the moon, these like small traces of oxygen and other elements are coming out that then are light enough to float above the surface. And eventually they disperse, but, you know, they're always there because they're always being replaced. And so we're seeing these types of mechanisms, not only in the moon, but also on Mars. We see a very similar situation where Mars actually does have enough atmosphere to make wind. And you can actually see some video from the Mars rover where there's dust clouds being whipped up.
Right. Well, the European Space Agency is heading to Jupiter to survey their moons. And now they may have been dismissed at one time because they're basically like ice balls, but underneath the ice, very, very deep oceans, essentially. So,
well, yeah,
you can even further expand to include planets, which we may not have, or moons, not necessarily in what we call the hospitable zone.
Right. So, right. Now, so that's very interesting because, as it turns out, there was no water on Earth, on the early Earth, because we're too close to the sun. And well, when it was super hot here and the rocks were all still, you know, cooling, it, like, basically we're living on a lava ball that's still cooling down, right? I mean, that's the point of any planet, is that it used to be a lot hotter and it's all gradually cooling down. That's just how universes work, I guess. But back in the day, like billions of years ago, the Earth was cooling down and rocks began to form. At that point, water would have been gaseous and just blown off. So all of the water that we have on Earth was not from the Earth's original formation. So where did it come from? Well, during that same time period, you have to go out past Venus, past Earth, past Mars. You get to where the asteroid belt is now. And right around that area is where it started to be cold enough for water to form in liquid form. So it's it seems like just purely by that that fact alone, you would think, oh well, maybe there's water in the asteroid zone, or you know, or out past that. Well, yeah, there definitely is, and there's definitely water on Jupiter and Saturn, and these have been verified by like spectrology and other experiments as well. A couple of years ago, I believe it was the Japanese space agency sent a probe out to the asteroid belt. Or actually, sorry, I'm getting two things mixed up. They actually intercepted a comet, and they slammed their probe into the comet and videotaped the whole thing. And from like basically their probe split in half, and half of it smashed and half was the camera. So what they found from that was that this comet is made out of quite a large percentage of frozen water, so ice or snow. It was very loosely packed. Basically, the whole thing was a snowball. Since then, a bunch of other work has been done just in the last couple of years in terms of searching for water in the asteroid belt. And it's insane how much water there is in the asteroid belt. So like everywhere they look, they're finding water. There's one of the biggest chunks that's in the asteroid belt is a object called Ceres, which is basically a microplanet. And it has a ton of water on it. I think I have the actual stats right here. Maybe not. Yeah, here it is. So Ceres not only has water, but it has like basically like a geyser, kind of like an Old Faithful type of thing.
Right.
And it's shooting water out from beneath the surface and shooting it into space. It does it at roughly, it's at 3 liters per second. So it's not very much. It's like kind of like pouring out a pop bottle, or well, maybe a little faster than that. Because if you can pour out a pop bottle in a second, that's way too fast. So anyway, a not insubstantial amount of water is just like spewing out of this planet. And that's not the only place. The same type of thing is happening on some of the moons of Jupiter. I can't remember off the top of my head which one it was, but one of them has this massive crater, or not crater, but like a geyser. But the interesting about Ceres is that they have determined that, let's see here, it's also got carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. All of these things are like kind of the basic elements of how organic chemistry works. So interesting. And there's a lot of other clues around those elements, particularly that we're finding, again, almost everywhere we look.
So all to again, reinforce the idea that Drake's equation, which came out like 1961, and the estimates were anywhere. I mean, it's almost useless. It's anywhere from 1,000, I think, to 100 million planets with civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, that's not very useful. That 1,000 to
yeah.
1 million. But
yeah,
I guess the point here is that even that, even if we're talking about 100 million, that's probably way off. It's we're saying it's underestimating. Perhaps.
I have no idea. Maybe there's only one. Maybe right. There aren't any. But like, because it's statistics. Who knows? Yeah. I took a statistics class at university, and here's what I learned. If anytime anybody asks me what the probability of that or that is, I say it's 50-50. It either will or it won't. That's all I can figure
right.
out.
Right.
But yeah, back to the Drake equation thing. I mean, I guess that is the crux of the paradox.
Right.
If there is a paradox at all, which there isn't, but if there was one, it would hinge on these two kind of two assumptions.
Right. So if there's 100 million planets in the Milky Way that are that have civilizations, where are they?
Right. So this is another part of the book, which, again, I don't dive too into the field of ufology in this book, but it has to be factored in. So here's the paradox, in my opinion. You have, I don't know how many scientists are on the Earth right now, at least millions. There's got to be millions of professional scientists. And there's also millions of people who are witnessing strange phenomenon in the skies, and or being contacted, or just have a lot of interesting stories to tell. Some of them sound super weird. Now, being weird is not an excuse to stop using science. Here's the paradox. Why is it that there's all this rich, hugely vast, rich field of data that's easily accessible to anyone who cares to look into it? I mean, especially now with the availability of Wikipedia and everything, all the other parts of the internet and Facebook groups that are dedicated to this and stuff like that. Anybody who wants to can easily become an amateur or armchair ufologist. So ology is the science of stuff. So you've got all these scientists who are basically not interested at all in a branch of science. This huge branch of science that's barely been touched is extremely data rich, but is a little bit weird. Now, so what that to me is paradoxical. Like, don't you find that if you were a person who wanted to know how the universe worked, you might want to look into this field of data?
Right. In other words, that's the real paradox. It's not whether they're here, but given the amount of anecdotal evidence, some trace evidence, I mean, there's a huge paper trail. Even the U.S. government and military are very interested. And yet, from a scientific point, it's absolute crickets. We'll take a quick timeout, and Ken Goodsword stays with us. The Fermi Paradox is BS is the name of the book. Back with more in a moment.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we're back with Ken Goodsword. The book is The Fermi Paradox is BS. How do we get a copy?
Well, at the moment, it has not quite been released yet. It actually comes out on February 18th. But I do have a special offer for you guys right now. If you go to my website, dimensionfold.com, you'll see the new releases banner. It's got the picture of the book on there. You can click into that. And on there, there is a link to a pre-order for Amazon Kindle version, the ebook. And I think I even have something about some other special offer. You know what? I can't remember exactly what it is, but for sure, you can pre-order the ebook. And if you join the mailing list, you know what? I'll tell you what. If you join the mailing list today, I'll go through and I'll assume that it's listeners of this show, and I will send you guys a link for a free PDF download.
All right, that's great. Thank you. Very generous, okay, my listeners. Keeping them, this is a pre-record, so it'll be maybe a week from today. What I'll do is I'll send you an email as soon as this goes live, and then
fantastic. Sounds great.
All right. So getting back to the real paradox here is that given the amount of evidence, anecdotal, trace evidence, paper trails, documents, and so forth, where is the scientific curiosity?
Yeah, exactly. So now we're starting to, the scientific community almost appears to be acting in a way that is almost more stereotypical with religious dogmatism, in that we've already made up our minds, and this is what we believe, so go away. We don't want to talk about it. That's not science.
No, it's the antithesis.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, too, because the scientific community eats their young alive if they do cross that line. And not even their young, but even their well-respected members. So I do want to talk about a guy named Richard Hoover. Richard Hoover is the world's leading expert in microbial extraction. So what he does is he'll take a rock, like any old rock, really, and if there is any like fossilized tiny microbial life forms in that rock, he can find it and get it out. Now there's other people on, you know, other people in the field who can do, who are, you know, trying to be as good as Richard, but I mean, this guy is like the king. He has this huge track record of all these cool things that he's found. And where it gets really interesting is a lot of the places that he's looking are in meteorites that have fallen to Earth. And so he gets shipped around the world because people are calling him, hey, we've got this meteorite. We want you to examine it. So he'll fly up to Alaska. He'll go over to Africa, wherever he's needed. And he performs his analysis, and he's able to extract these fascinating, basically tiny fossils. And he's been doing this for quite a long time. I can't remember his first one that did that, but I'm going to guess maybe 20 years. The guy's a legend in science. Like he actually worked for NASA for 45 years. He holds 11 U.S. patents. He was given NASA's Inventor of the Year award sometime during his tenure there, and now basically this, all this stuff that he's doing now is kind of like he's retired from NASA and now this is his new thing.
So he and found he's microbial. He found fossils of microbial life inside meteorites that fell from outer space.
Yeah,
landed on Earth.
Yes. Yes,
that should be
many times.
That should be New York Times big bold headline.
Exactly, and actually, to be fair, it has gotten some press, but nobody really knows what to make of it or whatever. I mean, it's in the paper. You can actually, if you Google it, some the New York Times probably did cover it, but you know, it's buried on page 50 or something. Yeah, and so the reason for that is because the scientific community poo-poos it. So even though this guy's got a stellar reputation, you have these pundits saying things like, oh, well, he made a mistake or he doesn't know what he's doing. Yeah, okay, so look at this. Okay, you know Mary Leakey, who discovered Lucy?
Yes.
She, at the time, Mary Leakey was the number one paleontologist. So this is kind of like saying, oh, well, I'm interested in paleontology. I teach it at Rutgers or whatever. And so I'm going to come and I'm just going to say that, well, I've never seen the skeleton. I've never been to the site. I didn't look at any of the evidence. But, you know, I don't really like what she's saying. So she's wrong and stupid. And that's essentially what the community is doing to Hoover. Like they're literally just calling him names. And you know, it's not that unusual because this has been happening to anybody who is even remotely academic, can't poke their head out of the sand, because everyone else who's got their head stuck in the sand, will kick that sand in their faces.
Is that because this
it's pathetic?
Because this is not the whole UFO ET issue is not a scientific problem; it's a political problem, and the politics dominate in culture over science. Scientists are dependent on grants. Scientists are dependent on tenure. Publishing is, you know, the peer review process and all that. It's all highly politicized. So, is that the issue here?
Absolutely, that's the issue. There are many scientists who have lost their jobs, lost their careers, in fact, because they got sick of that, and you know they did say something. So, in the case of a guy like Hoover, well, he's basically doing like freelance work, so it doesn't really matter if they're, you know, calling him names. But if you happen to be you know, maybe in your 30s or 40s, and when you stumble onto something interesting, and you happen to work at any kind of university or even a government lab or anything like that, if you find the wrong material and you say the wrong thing, things will go badly for you. I mean, the government does this too, and you know, we've all heard stories like, you know, some of the kind of UFO whistleblower guys, like I'm trying to think of a name now. Well, anyway, there's a lot of stories out there where people are even having their lives threatened, or you know, the CIA is busting into their home and stealing their shit. Like, that's not cool.
Well, like, and the gentleman out in Nevada that was studying Area 51 had a website dedicated to Area 51, and the military came in en masse. I don't know, there was like something like 30 or 40 individuals that showed up at his door. It was a no-knock warrant. They took away his computer. Right. They took away everything. No explanation even to this day.
Right. Yeah, I saw that on video, actually. Yeah, I wish I could think of his name, man. That guy's like, he's kind of a hero of mine, actually. But you know, my brain is getting old. but yeah, it's really sad that we have to kowtow to the popular opinion in order to maintain any kind of credibility. And why is that? When on the other hand, the people in power can say whatever they want with zero evidence, zero data to back it up, and we're just supposed to go along with it. There's something seriously wrong with that.
George R. New is the gentleman in Las Vegas. Sorry, I just
okay. I was thinking of someone else, but yeah, there's numerous examples where you know you find out something that you're not supposed to know. And then it's like, well, shoot, and there's a lot of other people who are in that same position, and they probably made maybe a smarter choice, and just didn't say anything. And then okay. There's all the,
so I was just gonna say, so given all that, we'll take a time out here in a minute, but we'll get you to address this on the other side. Given all that, you know, the suppression, of evidence, the intimidation, maybe we can refer back then to the Fermi paradox.
Absolutely. And I've got a prime example of that.
All right, we'll do that. Ken Goodsword stays with us. The Fermi paradox is BS.
This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Follow Richard on Twitter at Richard Serrett. For show information, visit the website strangeplanet.ca.
Ken Goodsword, Fermi paradox is BS. And again, just refer us to the website where we can do the pre-order on that.
Yeah, that's dimensionfold.com.
Dimensionfold.com. All right. So getting this, relating what we've been talking about, the suppression, the intimidation, the campaign of silence and disinformation, and how that relates back to the Fermi paradox, which again, title mm-hmm. of the book, The Fermi Paradox is BS, attributed to Enrico Fermi, the nuclear physicist in 1950, who posited, you know, well, if these UFOs are so, you know, if these ET civilizations are so plentiful, you know, where are they? So
right. So one really amazing factoid that I had no idea about until I started digging halfway through writing this book. So this comes down to suppression, and in this case, the culprit is NASA. Now, of course, NASA sort of reports to the government or Senate or something. I don't know how it works. But they're also sort of like self-sufficient. So it's hard to know who's making these calls or why. But check out this story. So in 1976, NASA sent a mission called the Viking mission. Mm-hmm. And they orbited Mars and they set down a lander. Now, this is an unmanned mission. We have not sent men to Mars yet, but we will soon. But basically, this lander set down on Mars and did some soil samples and stuff like that, and took a couple small vials of Mars dirt and brought it back to Earth. So we do have samples of Mars soil, and we've been analyzing those for 50 years or however long that is since 1976. It's a long time. Now, they've also, because the NASA guys at the time were sort of cognizant of their own limitations. And so what they did was they analyzed some of the soil, and some of the samples, they just stuck in a deep freeze and have never opened them. So I mean, good for them. That was very, very clever, and you know, showed a lot of forethought. So I'd like to see what happens when we open those. But here's what we already know. Now, this is crazy. Like, I could not believe it when I heard this. So right after they got back, or sorry, not even, they didn't even have to get back. This happened while the thing was still on site. So it's there. It's got like a little probe into the dirt, and it's like doing some analysis already and some various experiments that were designed ahead of time to try out different things with this dirt. And then they're beaming the results back through radio. So one of the things that there was three, sort of a three-part experiment that was designed by a couple of the top NASA scientific designers. Now, keeping in mind, if you wanted to do an experiment on Mars, you would have to convince NASA that your experiment is a great idea and one that they should spend millions of dollars on. So these guys already passed that test. These are people who worked for NASA. They were like their own guys. And they had designed a couple of tests. Now, these tests involved injecting certain chemicals, or not chemicals, I guess, but well, whatever, elements, injecting stuff into the ground on Mars. And then, depending on what was in the ground to react with it, they would see certain different results that would happen. Now, basically, it's kind of, so one of them used like oxygenation, and they were basically, the results would tell them what types of things were in the ground. There was one where they stuck oxygen into the ground. There was one where they stuck carbon dioxide into the ground. And there was one where they stuck water into the ground. Now, all three of these experiments had remarkable results, and they were able to capture those results. And I can't get into the technical specifics off the top of my head. I barely understand them myself, but it has to do with the types of reactions that life forms would do due to metabolism. So basically, every time the probe put stuff into the ground, it got metabolized in the same way that it would be if there were living microorganisms in the soil, whether that be fungus or some type of plant life, or you know, like a bacteria or something like that.
Sounds like you're saying life was discovered on Mars in 1976.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And so when the results were beamed back to NASA, the people who designed the experiments were like shocked and ecstatic, because I mean they didn't really expect to find life on Mars, but like so and I have their names here. It's Gil Levin and Patricia Stratt, and these are again are like high level NASA scientists. Now they literally said, okay, we found life on Mars, like, and they were ready to go to press with it, but they weren't allowed to. Now, both of these two scientists died just in the last 2 years. So one in 2021 and one in 2020. Both of them on their deathbeds still said, yeah, we found life on Mars. They stuck to it. I mean, they could be wrong, but again, these are smart people. This is kind of the whole thing with, you know, the Mary Leakey phenomenon again. You can't just say, oh, you don't know what you're doing just because you don't like the results.
Well, the other thing is, okay, maybe there's some question as to whether they were right. Maybe they were misreading the data. What's one of the major tenets of science? It's and an experiment is repeatability. So you try it again. Mm-hmm. And again.
Exactly. So in the time since 1976, when they got these, okay, maybe they're inconclusive results. So what does NASA do? They cancel all the Mars programs that were supposed to happen after that. And they don't go back to Mars until now. Now they're talking about doing it again. So finally... and it's probably only because they're scared that Elon Musk is going to beat them to the punch. And he will. Like, Elon will be on Mars, not himself, but he will have a device on Mars within the next 3 years. He wants to have people on Mars within the next 10 years. And I very strongly believe he will.
And
so he's joining forces with NASA now, and they're working together. So they kind of he's forcing their hands a little bit.
Right, as he did with Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Transparency. So that'll be very interesting. Ken Goodsword is the author of Fermi's Paradox is BS, and again, dimensionfold.com. And you can order an advanced copy. Check it out. And also, your very generous offer for people listening to this podcast, maybe they can use the code word.
Yeah. You know what? I'll just put a link up on that page, and the day that this show airs, that page will have a live, PDF download link. And then it's only going to be there for maybe a day or two. So take advantage of it as soon as you hear this show.
A free PDF download.
Yeah.
Very, very kind. Ken, great meeting you. Fascinating discussion. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. You too, Richard.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.